Welcome to the Morning Philip series, co-sponsored with the Bush Foundation and the NUMAD Group, hosted at the Garage. The purpose of the Morning Philip series is to discuss philanthropy, civil society, and community. It is an opportunity to have a conversation with good people, doing good things, creatively and collaboratively. The format is a conversation, not a presentation, a dialogue, not a pitch, two chairs, a table, and a community of interested people. And today we are pleased to have with us an international recognized performer, two-time Grammy winner. The NUMAD Group would like to extend a special thanks to the Cheeseman Center for Sound, Barefoot Dance Studio for chairs, Scott Sumner with Sumner Law for brewing coffee, Tamora, Chelsea, Kelly for setup. We want to thank the members of the Garage for letting us use your space, the Bush Foundation, and for everyone here for joining us at 7 a.m. Please join us on Facebook, engage in the conversation at hashtag MorningPhilip, and with that, please join me in welcoming Rozelle Brown.
Hello.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So, thanks for coming.
Thank you for having me.
It was just a short trip from Connecticut.
It was a nice trip.
Well, Rozelle showed up yesterday at about 7 o'clock. After a full day of travel. Yeah. I'm wondering if this morning at 7 a.m., you'll take us back to the first time that you started to perform, that you started to entertain the idea of making music, making sounds. Yeah. And could you take us back to that time when you were a kid?
When I was, I would say about eight, 9 years old, I think as children, we all, you know, watch television, cartoons. So I was one of those kids that watched a lot of cartoons. And I was always fascinated by the different sounds and the voices, particularly. And music was a big thing because our grandparents would play, you know, a lot of soul music, a lot of R&B, a lot of funk. So I was influenced by that because it was always a commonplace. Like every day they would play different types of music. So I was really intrigued. And I always wanted a tape recorder so I can actually tape these things. So that was always something on my wish list for Santa Claus. for Christmas, that's what I wanted. I'm like, I wanted a tape recorder. So I'd got a tape recorder and I used to tape everything. I would tape this people walking outside. I was just one of those little quirky kids that was intrigued by different things, just my surroundings. And that was my escape, pretty much. You know, coming up in an urban area sometimes could be a little bit rough and, you know, you have a lot of bad influences, but that was kind of my refuge, my escape, just my little world that I was in. So that was kind of like the beginning phases of, you know, me being inquisitive about different things.
Was the, when you said you taped everything, it wasn't just music, it wasn't just...
No, it was people talking, and I would play it back and just listen on conversations. I was like, wow. It, you know, I mean, the government does it. You know, and
and you were doing it in the 70s.
And I was doing it myself, but you know, I was just, you know, it's just funny listening to people have conversations and the things that they talk about. Mm-hmm. I thought it was hilarious, you know, as a kid, and I used to imitate these people. And in school, you know, they used to call me a class clown because I would imitate, you know, these conversations, and people were like, "What is he doing?" And it was funny to them. So it was funny to me listening to it, but then when me playing it back in front of my friends, they was like, "You're kidding me. Like, this is actually happened?" I'm like, "Yes, it did," you know?
So when did that turn into beatboxing for you?
Now, beatboxing, that turned into, that came about with the progression of hip hop. Mm-hmm. It was more of a community thing. Like, you know, a lot of the DJs would come out in the parks and play different music. You know, it's kind of like a little house party on the block. So people would come, you know, have drinks, you know, barbecue.
Just like across the way, at the park across the way.
Yeah, just pretty much just get a get together. Mm-hmm. But these things started to grow, like every neighborhood used to have them. And a friend of mine, we decided to get like a little group, because this is like the explosion, like everybody had groups. You know, it's kind of like the doo-wop days, but with hip hop, it's like, yeah, we went out to, and bought shirts with names on it, and and it was real corny, but you know.
Can we pop, what name did you have on your shirt?
Back then, I was in a crew called Positive Sound. And we had one rinky-dink turntable, and we used to play Nile Rodgers' song called Good Times, which turned into Rapper's Delight. You know, it was like a real popular song back in 1979. So we used to play this record over and over again, and the needle was so dusty. And, you know, we tried to do our little routines together. And then one day I was just in the house with the tape recorder, and I was just taping myself trying to imitate the record. So I just kept taping it, and I'm listening back. And my older brother at the time, he was like, "That's kind of cool." I said, "Play, let me hear it again." I said, "That almost sounds like the record." So I just kept practicing and practicing. Then one day we were having rehearsals. And you know, we're in my friend's Wayne's house. We always go to Wayne's house. He had the broken turntable. So the turntable didn't work this particular day. So I said, "What are we gonna do? We don't have a turntable. Anybody can go borrow a turntable?" I was like, "Hey, I can do it." It's like, "You got a turntable?" I was like, "No, I could do it with my mouth." It was like, "No way, you can't do it." And then I started to do the record Good Times with my mouth, and everybody was just sitting there going like this, "No way." They was like, everybody was like, "We're so in," like it was groundbreaking, because everyone, the format was, you know, you had a DJ, and then you had the MCs. With our crew, we had no DJ. Mm-hmm. We had me. So all the, you know, where everybody start talking like, "They don't have a DJ, but they can still do it." Everybody want to hear this. Mm-hmm. So like some of the older guys that played the records and stuff like that, they was like, "All right, let's see what you got." So we would go to the park, and you know, they're jamming out, they let us get on. We do our routine, then I get on, and everybody's like that. No way. But then that's how it started to snowball, you know. It was cool to me. I mean, you know, it was cool. I mean, especially at 12 years old, you know, kind of like, you know, just doing that, I was like, I think I'm on to something. But I think the groundbreaking moment for me is I grew up in Queens, New York, born in the Bronx, grew up in Queens. So at the time, during the late 70s, early 80s, there was the influx of people from Brooklyn moving to Queens. Queens was kind of like the suburbs. So a lot of people were moving to Queens. So this one guy named Monroe, mm-hmm. He had this tape, and it had Disco 3 on it. And he was like, "I know this guy in Brooklyn that is way better than you." I'm like, "What?" So he plays the tape, and lo and behold, this is the group that became the Fat Boys. Mm. You know? Mm-hmm. And it was Buffy. And when I heard him, I was like, "Oh."
So what does that do?
I mean, at that point, that's when the competitive, because now you have somebody going, mm-hmm. "You're good, but this guy's better."
Is that how, because in beatboxing, there are a lot of competitions.
Yeah.
That's how
it organically happened, because all of a sudden people start to pop up in different neighborhoods beatboxing now. it started to become a competitive thing because neighborhood to neighborhood, like now we have a beatboxer in our neighborhood. I was like, you thinking, you know, you discovered something, but something that was already there and somebody already honed in on it. Then it was Dougie Fresh, and then there was a host of other people, you know.
Can we pause at that? Because isn't that a little different to have competitions in the music world? Obviously now we've got competitions on TV.
So American Idol.
So you guys way pre that.
It was the organic. It was you know, just the base root of how all of this came about. And then it wasn't like it is now. It's more organized now. But back then it was like neighborhood versus neighborhood, borough versus borough.
And one of the things that I've heard and that you've said is this idea of respect.
Yeah.
Because it was like what you can do, it doesn't mean it takes anything away from what I can do.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, to me, like the Fat Boys and Buffy, it was a competitive spirit. But I had the respect that he was pushing the envelope further, you know, like then when they started making records, that's when it was like the holy grail, like you can actually record and put this on a record. So that just opened my mind to so many others. That's when I really dove in head first, like starting to listen to all types of music, starting to go to different festivals, different park arrangements, you know, because New York Parks Department used to have let the DJs come out and play. You had to have a permit and stuff like that. So I used to go all over Queens, the Bronx, Brooklyn, Manhattan, Staten Island. So I used to go from borough to borough and just sit back and listen and see what the DJs were playing, because the DJ was the controller. Everybody came to see the DJ. So in my mind, I wanted to be the DJ, but without the turntables. So that's when I started to push myself. Like, okay, if you're gonna be better than Buffy from the Fat Boys, then you have to really know what a DJ is about. Because if you can control the crowd like an MC or like a DJ, then that's when you're gonna become popular. That's when you're gonna get better at things.
So can we take a step? It's a step back. Last night at dinner, you shared that your mother passed away a few years back.
Yeah.
And that when people when you share with folks that she's your mom, when you say her name or Miss Judy.
Miss Judy, yeah.
That people just light up.
Light up. Yeah.
I'm hoping that you'll share with us about that.
See how the sun just lit
I
up?
I did. I did. I saw it. I did see it.
Yeah. She's here.
Will you talk about that and how that is so meaningful to you?
My mother, she was a people person. You know, she loved people. People loved her. And I always wanted that, because I just seen how she walked in the room. You know, even if you know, you have some people that don't particularly care for you, but it was an overwhelming energy that you couldn't fight. So sometimes you had to kind of like, yeah, how you doing? You know, so the respect that she got, I wanted the same. Because it was a good feeling knowing, like my mother was like a celebrity almost, you know, but not famous on TV. Like in the community, she was famous, you know, and she knew a lot of other celebrities. I didn't even know that she knew until you know, one day looking through her photo album, and I was like, I didn't know you knew Ashford and Simpson. It's like, oh yeah, I go to their house all the time. I'm like real nonchalantly, and you know, and one of her best friends, her name escapes me right now, but she played Bill Cosby's mom on the Cosby Show.
Okay.
Yeah, that was her best friend.
Really?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But as she, you talked about, last night you talked about how the way that people felt around your mom, the feeling that...
Because she was a giver. She was a giver.
And that's a way that, that was a model, that is a model for how you...
She was a total giver, you know, and, you know, she always told me, and, you know, even, like I said, even people that kind of didn't care for her, she would still give. And she always would say, you have to let go. Like I was telling you, life is not the fantasy in your head. There's a reality, and, you know, and some things don't work out to your advantage, but you still have to move forward. You said the quicker you learn how to let things go, the quicker you can move forward. Mm-hmm. You know, and you have to forgive. You can't just hold on to things that didn't go your way and be angry about it. You'll never move forward. So I learned that from her. Because a lot of things as a kid, you know, I was upset about. And then she would always say, so what are you going to do about it? Can you change it? The only way you can change it if you let it go. Because if you hold on, you're not changing anything. Mm-hmm. So just be around her, and she have that type of energy and that type of feedback from something, you know, that's negative, and for her to be able to bounce back from those things. I've seen her go through a lot of things, and she was able to, same spirit. Mm-hmm. Nothing changed, you know. Some things can break some people because they hold on to it. She was able to just go, okay, I'm good.
Where did that come from?
I don't know. To me, everything is a decision. You make the decision whether you want to do something or not. It's really up to you. It's really no one, you know, no one holding you hostage but yourself. You know, that this, me looking at her, she made the decision, like, I'm not going to let this deter me. I'm not going to let this bother me. I don't like it, but I have to do something about it instead of complaining. Mm-hmm. So that's what I learned from her. She was a giver, so she always would tell me, like, you know, don't worry about what other people are doing. Even if they don't like you or, you know, they're in your way, find another way. Mm-hmm. Find another route. Mm-hmm. Because they can't control everything. While they're paying attention, blocking you this way, go that way. Or go underneath, or go over, or go through, or go around. Mm-hmm. Don't let that one way stop you from thinking you can't get into something. Mm-hmm. So.
I think you mentioned it was 1984. When you really broke out.
Yeah. I recorded my first record in 1983 as a rapper. That was my first pent lyric. So I wasn't,
and your
I didn't beatbox on a record then. Uh-huh. I didn't beatbox on a record till 1987. That was my first recording.
And speaking of lyrics, speaking of records, you've been writing since middle school.
Middle school, yep.
But what I was going to say, in 1984, you were working at J.P. Morgan.
No, that was 1991.
Oh.
Yeah, 84.
So take me through that, will you? Take us through that. Sorry, there's other people here.
Yeah. 1983, I recorded my first record.
In 83, you were 15. No.
No,
you were 12 and 8.
No,
anyways,
80.
It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
I'm
an old guy.
So,
83, I was 15. I was 15, 1983, recorded my first record. I was in a group called the Ever Loving Five.
So from positive sound to
ever loving.
Okay.
Corny. And I was MC Rozell, but I spelled my name the way it is on my birth certificate. I didn't like it. I had to figure something out. I'm like, I gotta change this at some time or some point in my life. I gotta change it. But I rolled with it. You know, it was an opportunity. I didn't want to let it pass, and I jumped on it.
But you released your first album. You went to college. And you were working at a bank?
Yeah, that was like 1990, 1991.
Can you talk to us about your banking experience?
In college, I went to school for engineering. It's the hardest thing ever. I'm sitting there like ohms and oh, like what? And I'm thinking like, what am I gonna do with this in life? Like what am I gonna do? I love numbers, but not these kind of numbers. Not these kind of numbers. So I decided to change my major to accounting. I'm like, okay, now this looks a little bit better. 1 + 1 = 2. Hate to dumb it down, but okay, I can add, subtract, you know. All right, got it. And I was one of those kids. I started working at 12, you know, doing odd jobs, bagging groceries, you know, landscaping, babysitting. I did everything under the sun. I worked for the Parks Department. I did some clerical work. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I did a little bit of everything, and I was really fascinated about saving money. You know, back then they had passports. Anybody remember the passports? Where you would go to the bank and you give them the book and they put your balance in there. And I was just watching it grow and grow. And I was like, oh, this is so cool. Like, I mean, I would say about at 15, I had like $8,000 at 15. And that's just me like just wanting to see. I had like three passbooks. Oh, this is done. I'm like, okay, I gotta fill this one up. So I was really fascinated. So I decided to go into the banking arena. Like, so I'm like, okay, I wanna work at a bank. I like the way money feels. I like counting money. You know, I figured if I'm gonna be around, if I want money, I need to be around money. I need to be around people that were making money, you know. That was my philosophy, and I pursued that. And in the midst of me pursuing that, the around this time where I took that course of action, because, you know, my oldest son was born. So now the responsibility of a child, you have to get a job, you know, either you're gonna go to school or get a job. So I was like, well, I have to take care of my responsibilities, so I'm gonna work. So I kind of put my aspirations of music to the back burner a little bit, because, you know, you have to put your kid first. But that desire was still burning while I was working. I was like, oh, I gotta figure out some way just to keep that energy and that creativity. So what I did, I looked for like open mics and little cafes and stuff after work that held these things, and I used to go and get on, and people were like blown away. And I just kept doing this over and over and over.
And you had, and somebody at the bank, right? Your supervisor at the bank.
Yeah.
Heard you.
Yeah, I invited them out.
Nudge.
Yeah, I was like, hey, you guys have to work, let's go get some drinks. I'm doing an open mic. And my boss came. It's just like, I gotta hear this, because everybody at the bank is talking about you. Mm-hmm. Like, I really gotta hear this. So she was like, wow, mm-hmm. I really like what you're doing. That's really good. She says, so what you gonna do with it? I'm like, I don't know, mm-hmm. You know? So I think the divide in the road was I was doing so many things after work, like I was saying, you know, I used to go to these cafes and stuff and open mics. That should come to work late, because I would get home 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, then I had to get back up and go to work. So me and my boss had a conversation, and she was like, I think you should really pursue your talent. I think you should pursue your dreams. Because you seem like you really love what you do, but you don't love what you do.
The same way.
Yeah, it was real, because she felt it. Like, I see that you really, I mean, you know, this is your job, but it seemed like you really love to do that.
Roselle, we do this, we do this conversation every month, and I'm thinking back of person after person that have had a story that somebody has recognized something in them or given them that nudge because they thought that they could do it.
Yeah.
And person after person has sat here and talked about that.
Yeah.
Like you talk about your boss, and you do a lot of stuff with youth now. Mm-hmm. You go back to your neighborhood and you go and work with folks in Connecticut and youth in different areas. Mm-hmm. Will you talk about the importance of that and why you decided to do that?
I think it's important to always give back. You know, it's important for the youth to hear someone's voice and someone else's experience. Because like I said, everyone has this idea in their head of what something is until you show them something different. A lot of the youth are going through hard times and some youth aren't, but you still have to expose your experience to the youth. You have to give back at some point, you know, because that's how the cycle continues, by giving back, whether it's monetary or just, you know, sharing your experience with them.
What you just said about everybody has this perception of something
until
you show that they,
because everybody feels like, you know, I'm the only person that's going through this.
Yeah.
Everyone in their head, they're stuck in their head like, No one understands me. But there are people that really understand your struggle. It may not be the same or parallel, but it's still struggle. It's still whatever you're struggling with, someone does understand. You just have to have an open mind to listen.
And I'm thinking about the conversation with some of your friends out east, and you explaining that you're coming to South Dakota to do this and perform tonight, and their thoughts about that.
Yeah, they're like, oh, you know, make sure you get your picture on the Mount Rushmore, you know? or, you know, you get the ride with Crazy Horse, you know? So, but to me, just having those conversations, it starts dialogue, because they're like, wow, South Dakota, I never thought about that. So I'm like, okay, I'm going. So when I come back, I'm gonna tell you how it is. So you need to go. Because, you know, everyone has a life, everyone has family, everyone has a job, everyone has things to do. And, you know, we get caught in our bubble, we get caught on the treadmill, and it's day in and day out, and we never pursue anything outside of that. Mm-hmm. To me, it's like, take a moment in time and pursue something outside of what you do as your regimen, as your routine every day, or as your routine in your life. You know, pursue something outside of that. Because you might learn something, you know?
Mm-hmm. And as we were talking and driving from the airport, this is exactly like it is in Connecticut and New York City, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. One of the first things
it's closer to Connecticut than New York, you know?
So I have a quote here that I'd love to hear your thoughts on. The quote is, beatboxing, like graffiti, began its life as an urban art form.
Yeah.
Will you talk about that?
I mean, I wouldn't say it began as an urban art form. I think it's just the cycle of life, you know? It's kind of like hieroglyphics, you know? Because if you go back to the ancient times, they drew on the wall. They drew signs. You know, like, you knew what was going on during that period. Graffiti is kind of the same way. Like, you know what's going on in the neighborhood because you got the artists putting up a mural. So you kind of know, like, okay, where we are, or a sense of what's going on, depending on the different artists or what they're putting up on the wall. And the same thing with beatboxing. You know, it's always been a form of communication. I mean, there's There's tribes that actually, that's how they communicate, through sound. So, I mean, it goes further back. So it's kind of like things evolve, you know, especially when it's organic. It always evolves into something else. It's always, I call, you know, it's a derivative theory. You know, it's always a derivative of something that started before, you know. Mm-hmm. So, but in that particular case, it derived in an urban community. It spawned into this from what we had when we didn't really have anything. So those are the things that we gravitated towards.
So, so I want to build off that for a second. Mm-hmm. That if you're 12 years old and you're listening this, the, you're listening this music, and you're replicating it with your body. Mm-hmm. And you talk a little bit about this, about how you have to keep going deeper into yourself.
Yeah.
And my question is about knowing oneself, that you can, that you're willing to do that.
Yeah.
Will you talk about that?
It's an exploration, because you really, you don't really know yourself. You're trying to find yourself. You're trying to find out, who am I? Like, why am I here? What's my purpose? So you have to, it's like an archaeologist. You have to just keep sifting through, okay, that doesn't work. That's not who I am. Okay, that doesn't work. That's not who I am. And you just figure out what makes you comfortable, like what you get enjoyment out of, what you most comfortable. Are you happy being angry? Are you happy being sad? Are you happy being happy? It's different layers, it's different levels, and you just gotta, to me, if it has a positive outcome, then that's who you should be, because you gotta pay something forward. You gotta give that energy out, but you just have to be willing to bump your head. You have to be willing to be like, okay, that doesn't work, you know, let me try something else, you know, but you have to keep pushing to develop. I mean, it took me a long time to figure it out. Mm-hmm. You know, like, this is who I am. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes you try to be something else, and it really don't fly. You know, you don't really feel comfortable.
But you still keep exploring.
Of course.
I mean, as we were walking over here, you were talking about different about projects and about keep trying to do things.
Yeah. Yeah. You have to, you can't be afraid of failure, because failure is this only a guide to take you where you're supposed to be. You know, it's like GPS, rerouting. That's what failure is. You know, that's what failure is, because everybody really gets stuck like, I failed, oh, it's over, my life is done. No. Rerouting. That's all it is. It's like, okay, we got to try something else. Maybe got to tweak this, tweak that. Maybe it wasn't the right time. So don't throw it away. Hold on to it. Try it again in 6 months. Try it again in 12 months. Because sometimes it's timing. You might be right on the button. You just have to be at the right place at the right time in order to make that situation happen. So a lot of people just give up because it didn't work when they wanted it to work, you know? People are so consumed with time, and I'm like, you know, oh, hurry up, let's get there. I'm like, it takes 9 months for a baby to be born. And you're rushing. It's called cultivation. You have to cultivate. You have to plant the seed, water it, make sure it has the right temperature. You know, it just doesn't happen overnight, you know? It's not Jack and the Beanstalk. It just don't shoot up in the sky. It doesn't work like that.
So if we shift gears a little bit,
mm-hmm.
Maybe unfair question, but so you, as a performer, if you weren't a performer making music,
I'd be at the bank.
Is there another art form that you gravitate to?
Home decor. But see, I didn't learn that about myself until later. Like, because, you know, I love art. I love art. So I've always loved art, like graffiti. I love art, but as I got older, I'm like, wow, I really love Bed Bath & Beyond. Like, you know, and it sounds weird. It's like, okay, like.
We'll leave that there. So you've transformed. You've done. When did you realize that you were doing something significant? Will you share your story?
Like,
will you share that story?
I was telling you the story about, you know, like the New York state of mind is so competitive. Everything is fast paced. Get her done. Get her done. Get it done. He's better. You ain't better. You gotta be better. Everything is like compounded. And you're like, I have to compete with Jay-Z. I have to compete with Beyonce. Oh my God. Oh, I didn't sell 9 million records. Oh, my life is over. I took a trip to Sao Paulo, Brazil. When I got there, everyone was talking about this 9-year-old kid. How phenomenal he was beatboxing. And I'm like, I can't wait to hear this guy because everybody's talking about him. And I met his mother. His mother was telling me, that's all he does is listen to your album over and over and over and over again. Like, I get teary-eyed because I'm like, how? Why am I worrying about, it's the fantasy. Why am I worrying about, this is the reality that what you've done has transcended around the world and it has affected somebody's life that where they could have, like I would say, you go left.
Yeah.
That's not the road you want to go. You go left and things go wrong. Something that inspired him, and there were older guys like 19, 23 that were phenomenal, but he blew them out the water. So at 9 years old, for him to grasp what I was doing and actually be able to replicate it at that age, I mean, at 9 years old, I was just blowing hot air. And for him to actually like soak it all up, I was just blown away. So that just kind of let me know that, why are you worrying about statistics and numbers and charting? And it's a bigger picture. That's your 9 million records right there. That you changed somebody's life. That you influenced them to do something positive. You know, so, that right there was a defining moment for me. Like,
will you talk about, what do you think the most important characteristic of a role model is?
I mean, like I was telling you about role model, like I really don't look at myself as a role model, because whatever you do in life, it's the human thing to do. Like, what's right is right, what's wrong is wrong, you know? And you should always pay that energy forward. You know, if you want a good outcome, then you have to put your best foot forward, even if it's not what you think it is, or even if it don't turn out the way you want it to turn out, but it will eventually spread, because, you know, it's just like yawning. It's contagious. Laughter, it's contagious. Like, anger, it's contagious. You could be having a good day. You go to work, and somebody come in, next thing you know, you feeling the same way, like, why am I here? Like, this guy's, you know? So, I mean, it's what you put out there, you know? And I think all of us as a society, that's the energy we need to put out there. We all need to be that model to put that energy out there if we want to make change, if we want things to be different.
Will you talk briefly about your soundtrack theory for the United States Congress?
I really feel like music influences people and it kind of changes the mood of a lot of things. And I think when they pass laws and when they have these big congressional meetings, I think there should be a soundtrack playing while they're doing this, because it would kind of influence them to do the right thing, you know? I mean, music is music, whether you want it to be drama, or whether you want it to be, you know, melancholy, so to me, to everything should have a soundtrack because it kind of can dictate what the outcome is going to be.
Would you provide a little bit of what you think the soundtrack should be?
Oh,
just,
God.
Just a quick second. Then I got a couple more questions.
Okay, let me think. Let me think real quick. Like, what would...
Or if you want to, you can make the music.
Okay, let me see. Let me see what's going on.
Just think about it. They're trying to pass a law, right? They're trying to pass a law, and all of a sudden, you know, you get this techno type of thing coming on. And everybody's liking it. I think we're gonna pass this bill. We're gonna keep Obamacare. That's what we're gonna do. Right?
Thanks. Seven-time Grammy nominated, two-time Grammy winner. Will you talk to us about that?
I mean,
so you get a phone call, or how does this work?
How it works is, you know, working with really great artists, actually, you know, helping them facilitate their vision. I didn't know these things were going to happen. You know, I was just open to something different, like with Sean Paul. You know, Sean Paul was a dance hall artist, and he was relatively new on the scene, kinda. You know, he really didn't have any really big records, and at that time, he signed a real big deal, and he with Atlantic Records, and he wanted me to actually write for his album. I thought he wanted me to beatbox. He's like, no, I actually want you to write something for a song idea that I had. So, you know, I wrote something for the album. I did a little beatbox snippet in the beginning, you know, just my, you know, my little stamp of approval. And, you know, that record went on to sell 3-4 million records, got nominated for a Grammy, and, you know, they sent me a certificate, like, hey, you was a part of this, compilation, and it did well, and we're recognizing your contribution.
Yeah. Will you talk a little bit about playing with Ben Harper and the experience with somebody like Ben Harper and his approach to music and performing?
Ben Harper, I don't know if you guys are familiar with Ben Harper. He's kind of like the Lenny Kravitz, but he plays a slide guitar, and he's not only a great performer, but he's like a great individual. Like, it's you know, most artists is about business. So after the business is done, it's like, okay, see ya. With him, it was never like that. It was like, no, we're family. We're working together, you know, and, you know, you're down. So after everything, recording, touring, you know, we still have dialogue, and it's rare in this business to find genuine people like that, because normally it's just about business. We're done. My number's changed. Doo-doo-doo. Sorry, the person you're trying to reach, it's not available. So with him, it's, you know, it's always been an open dialogue, a real professional guy, real down-to-earth guy, and that taught me a lot about people. You know, it's like, you know, everyone's not the same. Like we was talking about stereotypes. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you come into the industry with a stigma, like, you know, you're gonna get this diva, you know, people are gonna act strange, but then you get this bright light with someone that's just like open and welcoming. You know, when I released my solo album, you know, I was supposed to open for him, but what actually happened, I wind up just performing with him and his band, Innocent Criminals. So I was a part of the band, you know? So he's like, no, I don't want you to open. I want you to be a part of the whole set. And a lot of artists aren't like that. They're like, you're gonna open, you got 5 minutes. All right, now get off the stage. I've had that happen, like to some really, really famous people you guys might know. It was like, why is he standing next to my piano? It gets a little tricky, it gets a little weird. And you would think like, you know, we're human, you know? Okay, you make great records and you're very talented, but you know, you don't demean people in the process. That's not the energy you're supposed to put out.
Can we talk a little bit about misunderstandings and misperceptions or stereotypes?
Yeah. I mean, it happens all the time. Like we was discussing, like, you know, you have to have that dialogue with people to understand, because everyone's meaning of something is totally different. You know, like I could say, that's dope. To some people, like, is he talking about drugs? You know, so it's you know, it's how you communicate. Like, if I say dope, you automatically think it's something negative. But if you have the dialogue, like, what does dope mean? Dope means good. It's awesome. It's like great. And you're going, what? Like, it does. But yeah, we've taken a negative word and we've made it a positive word. So that's how things can get misunderstood without the dialogue, because you hear something, then you're like, oh, I don't understand that, or it comes off wrong, you know?
How about humility was another word that has come up a bit, Rizzo?
Yeah, I mean, you have to be humble in every situation. I remember one time I was touring the West Coast, and I met this young lady. She was a sculptor, and she would sculpt things out of wood. So she had all these different trinkets and different statues, and she said, I want to give you a present. She said, you can pick anyone that I have. She had it on all these statues on the mantle. So there was two that really stood out. I was like, what did this one stand for? It was like a phoenix, a wooden phoenix. She said, this one is for creativity. And then there was this huge statue. It was of Buddha bowing. I was like, I want that one. I said, what does that mean? She said, that's the humble Buddha. See, now she said, and she blessed it. She's like, now this is gonna be your personality. This is gonna, I still have it till today. It's in my house, and I really believe that's my character. That's a part of my character, being humble, understanding that every moment is a precious moment and you shouldn't take it for granted. You know, like this situation, being here, to me, it's like me winning a Grammy, you know? Because you don't get the opportunity. It's not like an everyday thing. You don't get the opportunity to do it. So when you have the chance to do it, you just have to embrace it for what it is. A lot of people really just take things for granted, like, oh, it's gonna be there when I get back. You know, life is not like furniture. It's not gonna be there all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, so we get comfortable. You know, we get comfortable knowing that it's here when I get back. Sometimes it's not like that. The reality is it's not gonna be forever. So you have to embrace every moment as it's your last moment.
You're born in the Bronx.
Mm-hmm.
At 12, you created music in a way that hadn't been seen before, really,
yeah,
in the neighborhood.
Yeah.
And is there anything that you want us to leave with? Anything more? That you want to leave with?
I think from my experiences, like, I know everyone goes through life and they have a perception of how things are or how they want it to be. And, you know, we experience different struggles or different roadblocks. You know, you just have to keep pushing. Whatever in your mind that you're afraid of or you don't think is gonna work, I think it's a possibility for everything. You just have to keep pushing. You just have to keep believing. You have to just find that one person that's gonna go to the ends of the earth with you on that journey. And thank you. You know, you just gotta keep pushing. To me, it's like all things are possible if you just make the choice. You make the decision to do it. Change is possible. You know, forward moving. Like I posted something on Facebook. Like another thing I've always been fascinated with was moving things. I like movement. So movement is good because that means you're going somewhere. And even this community, think outside of your community, because what you're developing here can influence other communities to do the same thing. So what you're building here is a great thing, and you just gotta keep paying it forward. Like, you know, inviting other communities to your community so they can get a feel of what you're doing here, so they can do it elsewhere. So it just keeps multiplying and multiplying and multiplying. It's kind of like me with beatboxing. It just kept multiplying and multiplying. I kept inviting people, come check out what I'm doing. And people go take it back and just keep multiplying. Now it's like it's in every country around the world. And it's phenomenal. I mean, with the help of Napster, the internet.
Rizal, this is... I just want to say thank you for
coming in to
Rapid City, for joining us, performing tonight with Sequoia and Andrew.
Yes.
We're really looking forward to it. The concert sold out, one of the quickest concerts, sellouts, and we're just really excited to have you here.
I'm happy to be here, and trust me, all night, I'm just telling you, you gotta come to South Dakota. You gotta come. Like, did you see Mount Rushmore yet? I'm like, come on, guys. Like, you know, I was telling them about, you know, the restaurants and, you know, just the downtown area. Now I'm gonna tell them about the statues you guys have of the different presidents. I didn't notice that until you pointed it out. I'm like, that's cool. You know, your Walk of Fame of presidents. That's kind of thing. I like that.
Well, we have a piece of art from the Susie Kappa Art Center, which is connected to Black Hills Works.
Okay.
This is John Summers' work, and we hope it finds a place in your home or office, and you remember us when you go back to New York.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
Thanks for that. All right. Stephanie Judson will be our guest on September 21st. She's the president of South Dakota Community Foundation. They're celebrating 30 years as a community foundation, and they've raised nearly $300 million, one of the largest philanthropic organizations in the country or in our state. She'll be here on September 21st.